Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Ad-Lloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
the Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ad's Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you. This week's book guest is A Man's Place by Annie Arnaud. What's it about? It's a woman reflecting on her life with her father and the life of her father.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, it's deeply personal without being dramatic. So weird.
In this episode, we discuss fathers,
French class,
adolescence,
and farms.
Carrie Ad.
Sarah.
We have a very thin book.
Oh, it's so thin. It's so light. You barely know it's in your bag.
I mean, it's basically a pamphlet.
It's a
size-wise, not contents-wise.
It's a theatre programme.
So this is A Man's Place by Annie Arnaud.
Annie Arnaud.
I love this author and I love this publisher. And I was with Josh, who works for Faber. We were in Bath. We were waiting for a taxi and he was telling me a story about the only thing Sally Rooney had agreed to do, and it was interviewing Annie Arnaud. But the pronunciation of her surname, which he pronounced properly, made me think that something awful had happened in the street. Because he was saying, oh, Sally Rooney, she agreed to interview Annie. Oh, no. And I said, what? And I thought that a taxi hadn't arrived or there'd been a crash. And he was like, Oh, no.
Winner of the Nobel Prize in
recently,
literature.
Yeah. With the Nobel Prize, you don't know the nominations, you only know the winner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They don't tell you've been nominated.
So anyone can say they've been nominated and you aren't disproved. Because I heard you were up for it this year.
Yeah. Weren't you?
Oh, last year. I was up for
it. Last year. To be honest, quite a few years. It's almost. I was like, don't worry about it, guys.
Yeah.
Just when I'm 80, let me win. Mm. It's like the James Acaster of Edinburgh.
Yes. Yeah.
I've been nominated that many times for the Nobel Prize. It's almost.
Yeah. You're the Acaster of the Nobel.
Yeah. It's almost embarrassing. I might stop writing because it's just too much to keep getting nominated. It's a Fitzcarraldo edition.
We love Fitzcarraldo.
Anything they publish is probably going to be fucking incredible. And we should just say it's translated by Tanya Leslie as well. She's still writing, Annie. She is 83.
Yeah.
She had a book come out last year, which people say fucking incredible.
Which book was the one last year?
It's the one about having an affair with a man 30 years younger than you.
Hello. That's my life. My husband's 6 years younger than me.
She's written 20 books in a career spanning 50 years, and she won the Nobel Prize in 2022.
Yes.
And the latest book is about her affair with a man 30 years her junior. The young man.
I love it.
Say what you see.
Yeah. Don't spend ages on the title.
There's no point. I've never read any.
So
Annie Arnaud.
I have read A Woman's Story and I read Happening.
Oh, yeah.
And A Woman's Story is about having a termination of a pregnancy as a young woman. And it's really, I guess what this thing, everything I've read of hers, it's really honest without trying to add any flowery writingness to it.
She's so simple and clear.
Yes.
Her writing is like and straight.
What I loved about this book in particular is it felt like occasionally she was writing about reining herself in.
Yeah.
Because as a writer, the writing wants to take over.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to write about memory or a real person, a real incident, she stops herself doing it. So it was, that. And then happenings about school. And obviously...
Are they nonfiction as well?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
She's just a writer. It's like a proper writer. She's just writing things down that's happened to her. Yes. And we want to read it because she's that good at writing.
It's so French.
Oh, so French.
She's so French. And you're so there.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at a sentence going, how did you get me into a cottage by just describing a hedge?
Like, she's sublime.
You're so there.
Sublime. Sublime.
So I added this into my basket for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gave this to me pre this podcast, I think.
Yes, because I saw it and it was about a dad.
Yes. I didn't realise it was about a dad.
Well, then as we started reading, I was like, it literally couldn't be more of a dead dad book.
It's a dead dad book.
Yeah.
You gave it to me. You must have told me it's about dead dad. Didn't listen. And a man's face started. I thought it was about a husband. So I just assumed a man's place is going to be about a husband. Mm. Started reading. It was like, it's a bloody dead dad book.
Yeah.
It's
it really
right
is.
Out my shop.
It really is a dead dad book.
It's absolutely about her dad who dies.
Yes.
And then her relationship with him.
Her relationship with him. And then just considering his life very deeply.
Can I just read a tiny bit?
Yes.
Which, just to go back to what we're saying, how she writes. So this is her just talking about writing this book. Naturally, I experience no joy in writing this book, an undertaking in which I must remain close to the words and sentences I have heard. Occasionally, I've resorted to italics, not because I wish to point out a double meaning to the reader and so draw them into my confidence, something I've always rejected, whether by means of irony, pathos, or nostalgia, but simply because these particular words and sentences define the nature and the limits of the world where my father lived and which I too shared. It was a world in which language was the very expression of reality.
Yeah.
Yes.
That distinction she makes about language, the importance of language to their reality.
Yes.
It then feels like it's this rule that she keeps to throughout the book.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I never ever was reading a passage going, oh, you've let yourself go a little bit there. Absolutely.
You're reading genius. We read lots of books. And this is one where you pick up and you're like, oh, I'm reading one of the great writers of my time. Like, this is incredible writing.
There is anything she couldn't make interesting.
No.
Because a lot of this is quite dull.
It's so dull. It's about nothing.
Yeah,
it's
describing a man in a shop, a man in a garden.
But imagine someone says to you, let me tell you about my dad. Mm. He was extremely working class and she became a teacher. It's not like she had this incredible mad separation from her family. Yeah. She just literally got
she
a teacher's qualification.
School. So her dad was pulled out of school as a 12-year-old. Well, anyway,
proper farming, pre-war, like French countryside.
And she finished school, and his insecurity about that is what the book is about. If I was going to say to someone, it's like, a parent trying to do what they can for their child and then feeling like they exist in different worlds.
Yeah, like giving your child that opportunity and then watching them not be able to communicate with you. He speaks a dialect.
Losing
he doesn't
them.
Speak. Yeah. So he speaks Normandy dialect, which is obviously different to French. And, at times when he's angry or frustrated, he can only communicate in the Normandy dialect. She refuses to use that because she's being educated and she sees it as beneath her. So language immediately separates them. Class separates them. She's become middle class because she's trained as a teacher.
But it
qualified.
Also separates her in the middle class. Mm. So
she's not. Her friends are much posher than
this
she
book is.
Is
the first time I've really been in the company of someone using the word bourgeois correctly.
Yes.
And then go, oh
yes.
And I wished actually for this episode we did have a French person who understands French class properly.
Yeah.
Because I can't just impose working class onto this.
Well, it does feel similar. There's but also I think what you have to put in context is the historical class structure. Mm. If you're talking about agricultural class pre-war.
Yeah.
And then the industrialization coming in with World War I and World War II and what happens to France after that. So not only is she separated from her father in that way, from language, education, she's also separated that he grew up in a world where you slept in barns, there were outside toilets, running water wasn't a thing. Like it's so much closer to Victorian times.
And he wasn't conscripted her father because of his
he was too old age, and he was ill. Something was wrong, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
And heart problems.
So he also has that thing of serving his country by staying and being useful.
Yeah. And she's able to maintain a relationship with her mother in a very sort of mother-daughter way. They go shopping or they talk about hats.
And her mum isn't as intimidated by her. She wants
Her mum delights in it.
Yeah, and she wants to learn from her. So she sort of borrows
phrases and like books and she's not, her mum is not an intellectual. She isn't trying to like, oh, you're having the life I should have had, but she isn't threatened in a way that her dad is so clearly. It's a character study of her dad, which I think this is the reason it's such a good dad book, is most people who write about their dads, I am one of those people, you are also one of those people, it's very hard to have a perspective on your father in that way, but I feel like it's such a clear and unsentimental perspective of what her dad is and was.
Well, I was reading this thinking this must be universal, and I'm sorry if anyone's listening going, no, that's not my experience of having a dad. But it's about losing your dad in adolescence.
Yeah.
And
well, some of us literally.
As a girl grows older.
Yes, losing your dad as a girl.
It's so much more complicated than just little girl and dad.
Little girl and dad,
simple. Caring for a child.
Yeah, because he sounds like he was a good dad when she was a kid.
I think he was a good dad all along.
Yeah, but like they have a nice relationship and he takes on the bike.
Simple.
And, really simple. And they... She doesn't question.
They fall over their hurt, you pick them up.
Yeah.
They're hungry, you feed them. Yeah. And that becomes so much more complicated with age, adolescence, the outside world, ambition. So it's a very, 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 very small story about things that are not extraordinary.
Yeah, it's so ordinary.
But it feels very, very universal.
Yeah. That's why she's so good. Mm. Because as you said, it is a universal story of a teenage girl.
It must be
rejecting
right.
her father.
It must be that the majority of people could tell you a version of, and that's when I stopped understanding my dad, or I was frustrated that my dad couldn't understand me.
I think you could use it for any teenager rejecting their parents, not necessarily the father-daughter relationship, but that is particularly what she's looking at, which is something we obviously particularly relate to.
Maybe that's right. Maybe the universality is, as a teenager, you start to work out who you are, and then you start to feel your parents either not keeping up with that or wanting you to be someone slightly different.
Or not having the ability to be the person that you are. Mm. Like, that's what's so painful in this book.
Yeah.
Is that her father can in no way be the human she's becoming. Like, he doesn't have it in him. Literally, he can't speak the language. His upbringing is so far removed from hers that he can't meet her.
No.
And that is sad.
Well, the feeling of feeling stupid.
Yeah.
And how you can't take that away from someone. He's not stupid.
No, he's not
no
at all.
No one is stupid in that sense.
He just doesn't use book language, I suppose.
He wasn't given that opportunity.
There's also a tension that he in no way chooses to have an interest in her life. Mm. Like, I know what you're saying, he's not stupid, but
he shuts himself off from her.
He doesn't say, wow, tell me about this. He takes it as an attack on him every time she
I don't know that he doesn't
understand. Yeah. And he's not generous or open-hearted. Mm. And that
he's not vulnerable, Brené Brown would say.
He's not vulnerable. He's not willing to do the work and be vulnerable. But what I think is so nice is she gives you enough of his background to explain why it's impossible for this man.
And that's why, and the work she's done to understand him years later, writing this down in this very unenjoyable way. Yeah, it doesn't read like, oh, it's, you know, the pages, the words have dashed off, streaming out of her. She's been so careful.
So considered. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's one of those light books that's so good, because you feel like every sentence has been quadruple million checked to be like, is this what I want to say?
I'm going to ask you, so we've talked about grief a few times because obviously lots of books have death in them, but the depiction of death in this book, how did you find it?
Brilliant.
Yeah. Brilliant, a brilliant death.
Oh my God. Well, you know, because we've had this conversation before where you've said, oh, it's a grief book. And I'd be like, no, it's not a grief book.
No, but this one really.
This is a grief book.
Yes.
But it's not focusing on the grief. Mm. So I wouldn't particularly recommend it for someone who's grieving. I wouldn't be like, oh, this is a grief book, but I would recommend it for anyone who has a relationship with their father they want to investigate, which I think is most people. But the way his death is dealt with is, like everything we've said, unsentimental, clear-sighted, very choice language.
The observation I thought that was so insightful is that the levels of grief in the community. So the father owned cafe and shop at the time that he died. And so some people are allowed to go and sort of say their respects to the body and some people aren't, based on, I guess, the level of
who he relationship. Liked as well.
Yes, who the mother likes.
Yeah.
But some people are just coming sort of for a look.
Yeah.
And some people are affected. And so the daughter, Annie, as the daughter is seeing, some people actually are saddened. Yeah. Oh, she describes how people keep saying the last time they saw him alive.
Yeah.
Because there is that shock when someone suddenly disappears, where they want to go, but he was just here two days ago.
Just here.
You know.
Because he has quite a quick death, doesn't he? He's not very well. And then.
And they don't really know he's dying, really. Yeah.
There was something she said, I can't find it, but the way the mum said it, the mum standing on the stairs and says,
it's over.
It's over or something. And Annie's like, what's she talking about? Mm. And Annie's also there with her child, seeing him become a grandparent and how wonderful a grandparent he is, how happy her child is in this mad farm. But I think when somebody writes things that are so real, that makes all other writing look like pretending.
Yeah.
Like the way she describes the conversations they have.
So it's very measured. So
measured,
we start off with his death before we have any attachment to any of the characters. Yeah. And then we get to know him a little bit more. And then
we come back to the
death. None of it ever felt like I was trying to be emotionally manipulated.
No, she's not. She's just telling you the facts.
Lots of writing is supposed to be emotionally manipulating us. And that's not a criticism. That's what it's supposed to be doing. It's entertaining. We want to be stimulated. Whereas this book goes much deeper. So we mentioned on a different episode about sort of reading together in a nightclub. Mm,
yeah.
And this is the kind of book where you wouldn't want to be too cozy lying down.
No,
you wouldn't want to necessarily
be on a beach. You could
read this
in a French cafe.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say. You could have an espresso and a cigarette and
I think that's what Annie wants you to do.
Yeah,
definitely.
Sort of very deep-brained about it.
Can I read a bit? He said the rest of the time he led a quiet life. When I got back from school, he'd be sitting in the kitchen right next to the door that led to the cafe. He would look up. Ah, here comes the girl. I'm starving. There's nothing wrong with that. Take whatever you want. Happy to feed me, at least. We talked about the same things we did when I was a little girl. Nothing more. Like that three bits of dialogue. You know their relationship.
Happy
you
to
understand.
Feed me, at least, I thought was...
Like he can feed her and he can say, here comes the girl, but he cannot engage with her life, what she's doing, anything.
Again, to impose modern, you know, it's that love language thing.
Yes.
And it's a very, very unflowery way of saying he did love me.
Yeah, he did. He lit in his way.
And caring. Feeding someone is actually huge, especially for someone who was hungry for so much of his life.
I know.
Like the description, actually, just sorry to jump around so much. There's that one where... The farmers are all fed meat and the meat's moving because there's worms underneath it.
Because they've got no food, they've got nothing.
So knowing that detail about his dad's life and then him going, nothing wrong with that, going to fill that belly, really means something.
Yeah. And I think also it's very bittersweet because it's always from the hindsight of after his death.
Yes. So this is remembering.
You know she's arranged all these thoughts after he's died. Mm. She's been able to see him. And this is the thing about death. When somebody dies, you have their full narrative. And so you can stand back. And that's why people say things like, how they live their life, because you can suddenly properly see an end to this life.
There's a line from his funeral, which was the first thing that I underlined because I found it so beautiful and so sad at the same time. He was an honest, hardworking life, a man who had never done anyone any harm.
Yeah.
Because that could sound like a nothing sentence, as in there's no activity in it. But actually, it's huge to not do anyone any harm.
I know.
That's huge. And it's huge to say about a parent.
Yeah.
They didn't do me any harm. Because actually...
I know. And that's why it's such a good book. Because it's not afraid to go into the depths, as you said, of like teenage girl-father relationship. Mm. Of how disappointed she is with him. Like, I think that's the other thing this book is full of.
Yeah.
She is upset and hurt and disappointed with him as a teenager. And then when he dies, she's able to look back and go... which is a very modern thing to do, to go, well, I understand why he behaved like that. But she doesn't shy away from how much she was embarrassed of him.
I think this is as you describe it, it's so clear. What's really difficult about being an adolescent is not being able to switch off the judgment of your parents.
Yeah.
So you sort of hate them for making you feel the way about them that you do, which you hate. You hate your horrible, harsh judgment of them. They are your, you know, have been the majority of your world. And you think the most... you know, shallow,
Well, also it's such a change from when you're a child and you think they're perfect. Everything they say is amazing.
It's so wonderful thinking your mum is a princess and the most beautiful person in the world. And your dad
knows everything
and can protect you from everything.
And then being like, oh, they don't know what they're doing. they don't fucking know what they're doing. Yeah. And that realisation of like they're human, which
it's really hard, even when they're doing nothing hugely wrong other than existing.
What did this book make you feel about your relationship with your dad?
Where I feel very lucky with my dad, not just his survival,
his life,
is my dad, and it's quite a rare quality, has changed.
Yes.
And changed vastly for the better.
Oh, that's a great quality.
It's amazing. In terms of
being willing to adapt and move forward.
To listen.
Yeah.
To take on the feedback. Like his relationship with me and my sisters, one of which is actually, she's in Australia at the moment with him, my younger sister. Like, that's a massive thing for a parent to do. To listen to the thing of like, you didn't do this and you did that.
Yeah, and to actually not throw it away and be defensive.
And it's taken years.
Yeah.
Since, you know, post-university I went to Australia. But so that's what I kept thinking is, if you are lucky enough to have a parent who is alive, who you can do the work with, because there's the other side, which is a parent who is alive and you can't.
Yeah.
And it just feels like, okay, it's just stasis. We can do this. A book we really want to talk about, Gwendolyn Riley, My Phantoms, shows the tragedy of them still being there and you can't move past. You can't.
I do think that's terribly painful for people. And I know so many people experience with their parents is like, oh, I could never tell them they're doing anything wrong. Yeah. And I could never say, oh, hey, can we communicate like this? It's like, this is how it is. That's the end of the conversation.
The very least someone can do is go, I didn't mean to do it. I can see why it made you feel that.
Yeah, or be allowed.
Or I'm sorry that something
give you the
felt
space
you that way.
To say it. And I think that's what this book is like ringing with, is like she couldn't quite say these things when he was alive. He wasn't a man who wanted to talk.
Yeah.
And he said this language thing. He didn't have the language himself and he didn't like her using proper French. Or no, there's a bit where she says he insists on her using proper French, but obviously doesn't want to talk about feelings. But he insists because he's got her this education that she speaks properly, but it's a language that he doesn't use.
Yeah.
So I think it's very heavy with things unsaid in a way.
And what does that mean? It means you lose intimacy with somebody,
doesn't
it?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not.
But yet there's still so much love. Like you said, that's what I think she's captured is the complexity of perhaps not being able to communicate with someone. They don't know your inner thoughts. They don't know what you care about, but you still... The love is still there.
Yeah.
That's very hard to get down in words.
Yeah. And also why your very existence can sort of prickle someone and it's not your fault and it's not their fault.
Mm.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I love her interruptions as she's writing about her as a writer writing.
Yes.
Because towards the end, she also describes how she doesn't want to finish it.
Yes, which I really related to.
Having
written a book about my dead dad.
So when you were writing your book and you did have to go back to memories of your childhood or your dad being sick, was there this sense of at some point I'll have to like resolve or... have an ending.
Like, it was horrific having to go back to the memories, particularly of him. The childhood stuff is fine, but the memories of him getting ill, being told, because obviously that's like 2-3 months of my life that are very like intense. That was really, really hard. And then as the book missed deadline after deadline, I did have a moment when I was like, oh, I don't want to finish it. That's what's happening. I don't want to finish it because I'm saying another goodbye.
Yeah.
Because it's another, like, I'm probably not going to write about you in this way or live these feelings again. And I was like, oh, in a therapy session. I was like, I'm struggling to, because I struggle with endings anyway because my dad died. And I struggled to finish that book because it was like, yeah, it's you're living with them again. And even if you're talking about them dispassionately or passionately or investigating your relationship, they are alive in the writing process. And your connection with them is alive in your imagination. And then having to put that to bed going, well, that's done.
I wonder with writing as well, if there's that narrative, that version of a narrative then becomes permanent. Whereas something about thinking about someone, memories.
And it's much more fluid.
Yeah, it's thinking about them this way today, or in this mood, thinking this, you know.
Well, also you capture, like she's capturing an essence of a person.
Yeah.
And you are capturing your memory of them, not anyone else's. Obviously, like her mum would disagree or his friends would disagree. And you are capturing...
Do you think he had friends, her dad?
Yeah, I don't know.
He seemed to have such a solitary life.
I just want to read this when she describes him. He was a cheerful man. He would often joke with the customers who enjoyed a good laugh, veiled references to sex, scatological allusions. Irony was not his forte. On the radio, he listened to quiz shows and the chansonniers. He was always ready to take me to the circus, to see silly films, to the fireworks. At the funfair, we'd go on the ghost train and the Big Dipper.
It's no coincidence, class-wise. Smutty jokes and those sort
circus,
of like big fun things. Like, you know, with the fortnight holiday, which in Essex working class, that's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
To have those moments out of...
But it's like it's like scheduled joy.
Yeah, because scheduled joy.
The light working class life, in especially what he grew up with, is so like full of drudgery and pain and coldness and hunger. And then you have, this is when we go and do our enjoyment.
Yeah.
It's done, now we go back to this life.
Just while we're on that, the way that her family despises their customers.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a vintage shop where, number one, lots of people are very poor, as are they, sort of existing, which means that stuff is on credit.
Yeah, they have to provide credit for everybody.
And then their hatred for people who don't come into the shop, the fact that they don't go to the bakery next door because the baker doesn't shop with them.
They go to the big supermarket.
For a kilometre for their bread.
Yeah.
I found all of that so amusing.
Yeah.
Because of course that's how you'd feel as a shop. I have an ego around stand-up. And so you'd have all of these versions of that, like a stand-up who doesn't stay to watch your set.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
so the next time when they're headlining, bye, guys, sorry, I can't stay. I just don't want to. All of these little ways that we sort of note.
And obviously we note our status.
Yes.
You know, you're always noting status and what people mean to you.
And the fact that people come in when they've forgotten something from their big shop.
Yes.
They don't come in there for their things. How hard to be a little shop is so hard.
Yeah. They didn't particularly want to be shop owners. Like he was working in a factory and the mum is working in a factory at one point.
It was just the easiest thing financially for them to do to try
and
improve
mum's
their
idea,
lives.
Isn't it? And she describes, isn't it, like they have this like what now would be considered a beautiful French country shop and they rip everything out and they put new things in.
They don't
in.
Like the old stuff.
They don't like it because, of course, actually, it's old and
that
horrible.
Was one of the descriptions that's told so much, is that when they are doing things up, he doesn't want anything fancy or anything. And by fancy, it sort of means like preference.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just says, well, just what everyone has. Just the normal way.
Yeah.
What do you want done here in terms of like painting or decorating, where anyone would go, what colour do I like?
He doesn't know what he likes.
He doesn't know what he likes. It doesn't matter what he likes. Just the normal way.
Yeah, just like everyone else. I thought that was really sad.
It is sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Because it gives, again, such an indication of a life where no one has ever asked you what you want your space to look like.
Because he's never getting had that to option. Choose something that you like is a privilege.
It's a privilege, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then being
and
like...
most of us would think, oh, you know, my bedroom or my... living room,
or at least my dream, if I had the money I would do it like this, and he hasn't even allowed himself to dream that. It's just like just whatever normal people do, whatever normal color and what normal sofa, I'll just have that.
Yeah,
but that's what I thought again so interesting, the way she paints that agricultural life that he's come from, the farm life, how hard it is, and again that feeling of
and
history,
child labor,
like, child labor.
There's a couple of times where you realize that it's odd having children now.
Yeah.
To imagine a time where, so she describes, or she mentions at one point, a daughter's being married off and the mum's not wanting it to happen too early because they lose 3/4 of a wage bracket.
Yeah, I know.
Because your kids work and you need their money for the house to survive. And the same with a dad pulling a child out of school, which is what had happened to her father, the dad coming and going, hey, it's enough now.
Yeah.
Because now you work full time. Even though you were already out at, you know, harvest and your weekends and everything.
That's what happened child to my labour. Mum. Like, not child labour. Oh. But she was forced out of school because they needed the money. Like, that was... she? Yeah, because it was like, why would you work... why would you go to school past 16 when you can get a job and bring money in?
Mm.
And I remember, like, my mum telling me that, me being really, like, couldn't get my head around it. Like, what do you mean? She was like, well, I had to go and get a job at 16. I was like, what? And again, that leap between generations of, like, imagining me at 15 having to go to the city and I would have been
having
fired
to give
in
the money
minute.
Away. Because the thing that I would have been like, well, and then you steal my money.
Yeah, because you're living at home. Yes. And if you want to keep your money, you've got to move out. Tough.
It's tough. Very, very interesting how quickly expectations change.
Yeah, like, exactly. In one generation. And I think that's what she captures so well of, like, one generation making a different choice, being allowed to stay at school, being educated, people recognizing her intelligence. Mm. And obviously, like, now she, this again, like, come back to her. She's, you know, in her 80s, she's a Nobel Prize winning author.
I'm running out of words to be hyperbolic about her intelligence.
Yeah.
Because it made me feel a loss of feelings. So she's reflecting again. While I was writing this book, I was also marking papers and sending out model essays because that's what I'm paid to do. Right, okay. Business. That's a job.
Business.
These intellectual games aroused the same feelings in me as luxury.
Mm.
A feeling of unreality and wanting to cry.
God.
She's marking papers, which is what teachers do, but she's also aware that this is a level of life which is play and perhaps doesn't really mean anything, and it's intensely enjoyable. It's luxury. I mean,
she describes her dad just here, which says, on another occasion, he was dumbfounded to hear me speak English with a hitchhiker who'd been given a lift by one of the customers. The fact that I'd learnt a foreign language at school without ever visiting the country was beyond his comprehension. He often said by way of apology, you know, we didn't force her. She had it in her about learning. He used to say I was a good learner, never a good worker. Work was only ever done with your hands.
Yeah, that was really interesting as well, isn't
it? And the thing is, she does work with her hands. She's a writer.
Yeah.
Like, but it... and she obviously toils really fucking hard over her work.
Well, they sort of, I guess again, it's that fear thing, but she learns all the time. She's always studying. They see the light on under her door.
Yeah.
That's what she does in her spare time because she enjoys it and they distrust it.
Yeah.
And are fearful of it. And yeah, needing to say to people, this wasn't us.
Yeah, this is...
we didn't... yeah.
We don't know what's wrong with her.
And also, it's like, I won't brag about her. I won't take any reflected glory, which another kind of parent really, really would. You know, I had nothing. Look at my child. I did this. And he doesn't take the credit. But there must be something about looking at their life and her. She doesn't really express this, but not wanting what they've got.
Yeah.
Wanting something else.
But then it's interesting. That's why I think she's so good. Because it's so complex. Because she's talking about, I don't want their life. I don't want to be a wife, you know, bitterly sniping at my husband the whole time because I sort of hate him.
The way they speak to each other.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah.
I thought that she captured the way two parents who obviously sort of hate each other sort of love each other so brilliantly. But she also has an empathy and an understanding for their life and their love. Like, again, it's just so... it's so weirdly unsentimental for a book that's very emotional.
And a child talking about their parents usually... I mean, and we would forgive it. That's all you have is sentiment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how can you see them clearly? They're your parents.
How has she managed to see her dad this clearly? I guess she is writing a long time after he's died, but still, like, so he dies in 67 and she's writing this in the 80s.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, I don't know, that's the gap maybe when I started writing about him as well. Like, to compare myself as Danny, I know. You do need that amount of time, I think, to see, for a parent to be dead that long.
Yeah.
For you to live your life, become completely separate from them, and then be able to go, oh, I can actually see who that human was now.
He and my mother would invariably address each other in reproachful tones, even when they were showing concern. Don't forget to take your muffler, and why don't you sit down for a while, sounded like insults.
So brilliant.
Isn't it?
So brilliant. It's how married people speak to each other. They've been married too long. And everything's slightly irritated.
And she's told us already that language was their reality.
Yeah.
So they mean what they say.
Yeah.
But there's something else in the way that they say it because they've lived together for a really long time. And then she does describe them arguing. Sometimes she would snap, talking about her mother, you weren't cut out to be a shopkeeper, meaning you should have remained a factory worker. He responded to the insult by shedding his customary reserve, slattern. I should have left you back where I found you. I mean, that's old school.
It's old
heterosexual
school.
Couple yeah. rowing.
I got a bit of Hello, Hello vibes occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I imagined him as René.
Now you're a shopkeeper. Well, yeah. You're terrible at it. Well, you're a slattern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant book. I feel like, same as we did with Deborah Levy, all we've done is say how good it is, but I can't recommend it enough.
No, I think
we
said a lot more because
it's brilliant.
Much more. So Deborah Levy, we absolutely love and like love her writing, but there's so much more in this book in terms of things I don't know.
Yeah,
French
true,
class.
True.
And what the author is trying to tell me about.
It's definitely made me want to read more Annie Erna.
Well, let's read all of Annie Erna.
And she's still going and she's still writing.
Yeah.
I mean, what an incredible...
I think you have to be alive to win the Nobel Prize. So maybe that really incentivized her.
You got a final line.
That's what I was thinking. Oh, okay. I have a question for you, actually. Because the actual last paragraph of the book.
Yes.
That's the first thing where I was like, I don't quite understand what you're saying with this.
Oh, I loved it.
Did you?
Yes.
Explain to me.
Okay, well,
why it's
if you haven't read the book, you don't have to listen to this section. But if you have, she has a paragraph at the end where she's talking about queuing in a supermarket, and one of her former students remembers her and says, is obviously embarrassed that she's working at a supermarket, and says, like, kind of, oh, it didn't work out with my technical school, which they have two, I think, same as Germany, that you can go to like academic school or technical school. Annie says, she seemed to think I still remembered her history, but I'd forgotten why she'd been sent to technical college. I said goodbye. She was already on the next customer, moving the stuff along with her left hand while the right jabbed mechanically at the cash register. For me, I love that paragraph because it sums up class and education and what it means.
And what her dad was struggling with.
Kind of what her dad was struggling with. And also from her point of view that you don't always remember the effect that you have on people. Like, she doesn't remember this pupil, but this pupil for her is like, oh, you were Miss Erno, you were this incredible teacher and I let you down and now you're seeing me work at a supermarket and you're going to realise I fucked up my life. But Annie isn't making that judgment. Annie is just buying her food.
So is it a bit like with her dad? Her dad was very aware of her learning and she didn't mean to have that effect on purpose. So she doesn't mean to have this effect on the...
I mean, you could definitely write an essay about that. I think she doesn't mean to, but also there is an element of Annie that is separate from that person, that is looking at her going, I am on the other side. I don't remember you. I'm still a Nobel Prize winning author.
But it's not superiority. It's just...
I think it's just
factual.
Truth. It's just Annie giving her truth again of like...
And then the girl at the till... She moves on, she carries on doing her job for the next person, and then Annie has disappeared.
And she's doing her stuff with her hands. She's working.
Ah, I see.
She's working. She's doing something with her left hand
yes.
or jabbing away
she's
with her right hand.
She's properly with her hands.
And
not
for Annie,
learning.
That's like, you're working, but yet for you, you still feel like, I failed the technical school, therefore this is a failure, rather than, like, what does it mean? It's, like, we're all just people trying to... I just thought that it is an unusual paragraph compared to the rest of the book. Yeah. It kind of drags you into the present.
Yes.
It's suddenly, you're not in 1960s France, you are, like, in 80s France.
She's an older woman.
Yeah.
She's an experienced teacher. She's got pupils that are, you know, grown up.
Yeah.
Her dad's been dead for a while. Yes, you're right. It brings us to now.
It just drags you forward and you're
good.
Like, yeah.
She's so good. I didn't understand it until
she's
it
so good.
It
she does
me.
That in one fucking paragraph at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say if you write, it's one of those books that's incredible, but also that teeny bit depressing because it's so good. You wonder what's the point of anyone else writing anything.
Well, I think it's how you learn. I think it's how when you look at your own paragraph and you go, I don't know why, but I hate it.
Yeah.
It's really good to read someone and go, oh, okay. Sometimes I'm not trusting words to say things.
Yes.
I'm not trusting clarity. I'm trying to over... If I wrote this book, it'd be like, right, okay, so I feel this way about my dad, okay? And it's because he did this thing and, okay, you might say this, but I definitely... He didn't say it, but I felt it, so it must be true.
Her and Deborah Levy are a complete exercise in if you want to make your writing more clear.
And in terms of our skinny reads...
Yes, skinny
which
reads.
Which for us are a necessity. But actually, you never whiz through them because they tend to be condensed.
Yes, yeah.
So you have... huge amount in them and they're very, very well written. Does that mean big books have got loads too many words in? I don't know. I don't want to be the judge.
We're not the one saying it. But Annie Erno is showing you. I mean, it's just that thing about genius, isn't it? It's like some people can take, you know, all the words and never to say a point, and Annie's doing it in like 70 pages.
And actually, the other thing about this publisher,
75
Fitzcarraldo, and why people should go and have a look at them, they're on Instagram, but lots and lots of their authors will be people that you haven't heard of, and then you realise is an absolute genius.
Yes, and lots of translated work as well,
yes,
which Stillborn was another one that we covered. Yes, that was Fitzcarraldo as well, which we hadn't heard of and hadn't read. Thumbs up.
Fun brows.
Fun brows for Annie. Annie? Oh, yes.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club. My novel Weirdo and Carriad's book in paperback, You Are Not Alone, are both available now.
Merci la reading avec vous.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, you know, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.